Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. For over 50 years, the Xerces Society, spelled X-E-R-C-E-S, has been working to protect invertebrate species that we all depend on to pollinate our crops and contribute to the health and fundamental workings of ecosystems. The Portland, Oregon-based nonprofit is science-based and effective, working with stakeholders across the spectrum to protect the little creatures we all too often take for granted, from butterflies and bees to native species of freshwater mussels. Later on in the show, we'll learn about the diversity of species that the Xerces Society works to protect with Endangered Species Director Serena Jepson. Then we'll examine their innovative programs working with farmers, ranchers, and homeowners with Pollinator and Agricultural Biodiversity Director Mace Vaughn. But first, we're joined by the Executive Director of the Xerces Society, Scott Black. He joins us now for a brief overview of their work and a bit of history, including how the Society got its unique name from an extinct butterfly. Scott Black, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start out with the name, Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S. Tell us about the origin of that name. As I understand, it has something to do with a butterfly.
It does. And it is kind of a funny name, and it's a mouthful. And our full name is the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Gives you a little more context. But we are named after the first butterfly known to go extinct, caused by humans, in the U.S. And that's the Xerces blue butterfly, as San Francisco expanded during the war effort in the 1940s. Buildings were built on the very last of this butterfly's habitat. And Robert Michael Pyle, who founded the Xerces Society way back in 1971, felt that that was a apt name for an organization that tries to stop the extinction of butterflies and bees and all other invertebrates.
Yeah, I was kind of vaguely aware of you guys before I started to do a bit of a deep dive into figuring out who you are and decided to want, I really wanted to have you on our show. But I was walking through a neighborhood here in Red Bluff, California, and there's a very beautiful yard in the Victorian district here that's just so green and so just very natural looking and just gorgeous. And like on a hot summer day, it's this little oasis of cool. And then there's a sign in the yard that says the Xerces Society and no pesticides used here, you know, et cetera. And I remember seeing that and go, huh, what's the Xerces Society? And then I decided to look it up and go, aha. So you guys do some very cool work. Tell us about how you got involved with this.
Well, I got involved with this because I just am always been excited about biodiversity, always been excited about the animals and plants and habitats around me. But I was looking for some focus in my life, and it became conservation, and it became science-based conservation. I am would think of myself as a conservation biologist. And yet I didn't want to just do the teaching route or the research route. I really wanted to take science and make it into action to help people act based on the best available information. And about 25 years ago, I was asked to apply to be the executive director of a tiny organization at the time called the Xerces Society. Only 3.5 staff at that point. And I jumped at the chance because it seemed to me ripe to grow and to expand and to help people understand the importance of these animals.
And when you say these animals, we're talking about invertebrates. And when people hear that, they might kind of glaze over. But, you know, we're talking about really important components of every ecosystem, you know, pollinators, everything from the, you know, the earthworms in, that make your garden grow and the pollinators that make your flowers bloom, you know, all of those things that are so fundamentally important that people don't think about. But as you know, they're vitally important.
They are vitally important. And yes, we do focus on invertebrates. These are animals that don't have backbones, as we might say. And it is everything from earthworms to bees to butterflies to beetles to snails to spiders. And these animals are really the base of ecosystems. They're the base of food chains. They're the base of energy chains. And you know, whether you're thinking food for wildlife, these animals are vital. Over 93% of songbirds need to feed their young insects, or those babies wouldn't evolve. If you like to fish, you can thank invertebrates in the stream where these fish live. If you like pollination, if you like healthy soils, if you like seed dispersal, if you like pest control, the list goes on and on and on. I like to say if you care about birds, you should thank an insect. And if you eat, you should just be thoughtful about how we're caring for this group of animals.
Well, you know, it is so important. And I know, you know, from my own experience as a fly angler and talking to people who have been doing it much longer than I have, that, you know, these insect populations that the fish rely on are declining. You know, without them, we won't have this awesome thing to do that we had loved catching wild trout, for me anyway, and lots of people like me. Could you comment a bit about, you know, the decline of those insects that we depend on?
Yes, I certainly can. There was an important study that came out a few years ago that summarized this, that found that the annual rate of decline for insect groups that are studied on average is 1% to 2% a year. And that may not sound like much, but a 2% annual decline is approximately a 30% decline over 20 years. So what Wow. we're seeing is, over the last 20 years, we've lost likely a third of the insects out there. And of course, you know, these are food for birds, they're food for fish, they pollinate our wild meadows and our crops. They're just vitally important, yet we're seeing these huge declines. And these are human caused, and we've got solutions that humans can help to stem these declines.
Well, let's talk about that aspect of your work. What are some of the things that Xerces does to try to reverse that trend?
Well, Xerces has a real holistic approach to conservation. I come at this as a conservation biologist, so everything is underpinned in science. And we are also a partnership organization, so everything we do is in partnership, whether that's with researchers or park managers or farmers or managers at our federal agencies. And we start with that applied science. We often take on research that really underpins how do we manage these landscapes and these animals to improve their outcomes, whether that's pesticides, whether that's restoration or management. We also do a lot of community science, where we harness thousands of people who go out and collect data for us. And this data is really important, but at the same time, they become huge advocates. So we start with the science, and then we use that information in all of our outreach and education, in our conservation planning, because we go deeper than just getting people engaged. Like, we want to change perceptions of insects, but we want people to take the next step. And often you need some extra help to do that. We also do policy and advocacy, because we know, and the data clearly shows, that although people have to be really a great part of this solution, we need governments. We need the governments at national, at state, and at local levels to step up as well. And then this all leads to, you know, habitat changes on the ground, whether that is managing grazing for the benefit of insects, you know, eliminating pesticides or at least minimizing them, and planting hedgerows on farms throughout the Central Valley, or just in the case of the gardener, planting a garden and stopping using pesticides. All of these work, and all of these are part of the solution. And that's our goal, is to crowdsource as much conservation as possible.
And can you just be like a member of the Xerces Society?
Oh, well, thank you for that. I get going on what you can do. That is hugely helpful. So anybody can become a member of the Xerces Society. We have over 20,000 members across the U.S., Canada, and other countries. And I will say that right now, membership is more important than ever, whether you want to support the Xerces Society because of what you hear, or you want to support any other nonprofit. We're under threat right now with what's going on in the country, and we need everybody to step up. And again, whether this is a nonprofit that focuses on equity or conservation or anything else, go out and support your nonprofits or their public radio, because all of us need that extra support right now.
Yes. Well, thanks for that. I was about to ask you about that directly, but you just answered it. I would say that with what's going on with our federal government and our NGOs, our non-government organizations like yourselves, they're under threat because they do depend on, you know, federal grants and things. So it's now's time more important than ever to support organizations like yours.
Yes. And we really are. There's been a sea change in how this government sees conservation and sees climate change. And we are really seeing the dismantling of funding revenue for nonprofits. But even beyond that, we're seeing changes in federal agencies who we have partnered with for decades to do really important work. Many of our federal agencies are vital for conservation efforts. Where you are right now, you're surrounded by federal lands, and it's a concerning time. And the more people can get involved, the more it's going to help.
Well, Scott Black, Executive Director for the Xerces Society, thanks for sharing your passion for invertebrate conservation biology and the wonderful work that you guys do. I really appreciated you joining us, and good luck in these challenging times.
Yes, thank you, and thanks for having me on. I so appreciate your interest.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our profile of the Xerces Society, a science-based organization dedicated to the conservation of invertebrate species that are vital to pollination and the functionality of ecosystems. In our next segment, we'll examine the endangered species that the Society is working hard to protect and restore. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our look at the Xerces Society, a nonprofit science-based organization in Portland, Oregon. The Society works to protect imperiled invertebrate species. Joining us now to talk about those vitally important living things is Serena Jepson. Serena is the Endangered Species Director for the Xerces Society, and she joins us now. Serena Jepson, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. I'd like to know a little bit about your background. Tell us about how you got interested in conservation of invertebrates.
So I grew up on a farm and I spent a lot of time outside. So I think it started when I was really young.
Where was the farm?
In rural Western Oregon, outside of the town of Corvallis. Mm-hmm. And it was actually after college that I, with my dad, discovered a feral honeybee hive in the barn, and I got really interested in pollinators and pollination, so ended up going back to school for entomology, and that eventually led me to working at the Xerces Society.
And tell us a bit about your role there.
Yeah, so I am the Endangered Species Program Director at the Xerces Society, and I work with a team of about 20 conservation biologists to conserve a wide variety of endangered species. And we do everything from applied research to running community science programs to developing technical guidance to help a whole suite of people better manage for at-risk invertebrate species. We engage in some advocacy and work to change policies, and we do some on-the-ground restoration, all with the goal of conserving endangered species.
Yeah, well, and that's very important nowadays. It's always important, but now more than ever, it seems like. Let's discuss invertebrates a bit. For people who, you know, when they hear that word, they might not really know exactly what are we talking about. What are the major types of invertebrates that, for example, that you work with?
Sure, yeah. So invertebrates is a really large category that includes a lot of different groups or phyla of animals. They're all animals without backbones. So insects are the bulk of invertebrates that we work on. Also mollusks like snails and slugs and freshwater mussels are a type of invertebrates. And then there are several other types as well, like worms, like the annelid phyla, and ocean-dwelling creatures like sponges, for example, or echinoderms, which includes starfish. Those are all different types of invertebrates. But at Xerces and within the Endangered Species Program, a lot of our work is on insects and mollusks.
Well, and before we get into some of the specific invertebrates that you work with, the endangered species, could you just generally talk about how important these living things are to the natural world and all of the ecosystems that every living thing depends on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, invertebrates are essential to our environment, and they are really quite overlooked in mainstream conservation. I think that is changing, but they are really the basis of many of our food chains. Invertebrates represent the vast majority of described animal species on the planet, I think around 95%. And they make up more than half of our global biomass of animals. So they perform a wide variety of ecosystem services. They're well known for the pollination service that invertebrates perform. Pollinating more than 85% of flowering plants require a pollinator to reproduce, and usually that's an insect. They play a really important role as food for wildlife. So like songbirds, for example, 96% of all songbirds rear their young on invertebrates. And then we think about the other things that birds eat, like seeds and fruit. Those typically all come from plants that are pollinated by an insect. So for all sorts of other types of wildlife, invertebrates are really important. They also play important roles in decomposition and soil health. So dung beetles, for example, are really important in cleaning up rangelands. This is something that most of us don't think about or appreciate, but an older estimate, actually by John Losey and Mace Vaughn, I believe you'll be talking with Mace Vaughn on this show as well, is that ranchers are saved about $350 million per year through the ecosystem services that dung beetles provide in recycling waste on rangelands. They also play a really important role in pest control. So a lot of people think of invertebrates and specifically insects as pests, as, you know, pesky mosquitoes or crop pests, but really only 1% to 3% of all insects are considered pests. And the vast majority of insects that we have are actually performing really important and valuable ecosystem services, including as pest control, as being natural enemies of those pest insects. Invertebrates also can play really important roles in maintaining water quality. So freshwater mussels are one of the species groups that we on which we work quite a bit. And they, when in high densities, can play a really important role in filtering water. They act as like the Brita filters of our rivers, and they can filter out pollutants like E. coli, particulate matter, and really improve water quality. And then also, just lastly, this isn't necessarily an ecosystem service, but I think they provide a really important source of inspiration and wonder, whether that's the butterfly flitting by on an early summer day, or the fireflies you see at night in the summer, depending on where you are in the country, or even watching bees in your garden. I think they inspire a lot of people.
Yeah, certainly. There's just nothing that puts a smile on my face quicker than seeing a butterfly flitting around the flowers in our backyard, for sure. Okay, let's go through some of these, the ones that you really primarily are focused on. Let's start with the butterflies, especially the monarch butterflies, because they're a huge story. And I remember as a child growing up in Southern California, going to places like Morro Bay and seeing, you know, thousands of monarch butterflies as they were migrating through. And now you just don't see that as much anymore. Tell us about, you know, what's going on with our butterflies.
Sure. Yeah. So we at Xerces work on butterflies, many butterfly species and butterflies generally. And then specifically, we work quite a bit on monarch butterflies. And I think monarch butterflies have been in the news a lot lately, and I can talk about them first. Monarchs are widespread across North America, living really in the whole United States, the whole continental United States, southern Canada, and central Mexico. And they are a species that's been relatively well studied. We have the World Wildlife Fund tracking their population in central Mexico, where the eastern population overwinters every year. And then the Xerces Society runs the Western Monarch count in California to track their population. And in both cases, we've seen really extensive declines since the 1990s, and even in the West since the 1980s. We estimate there were millions of monarchs in the Western U.S. in the 1980s, overwintering in California. And this last year, we had less than 10,000 monarch butterflies. And this is really our second lowest year ever.
What are some of the factors that are causing this?
So monarchs face a lot of threats across the country. In the East, their declines have been strongly tied to increased herbicide use and the onset of genetically modified herbicide-tolerant crops, which came about in the 1990s, along with other factors, along with increased insecticide use and drought, limiting resource availability and impacts at their overwintering sites. In the West, the major threats really are habitat loss and habitat changes at their overwintering sites, various impacts of climate change, and pesticides in the West. We don't have as strong of a link in the Western U.S. to the herbicide story as we do in the East, but certainly many pesticides and insecticides in particular are challenging the Western monarch population. So we work to monitor the Western monarch population through a large volunteer network, the Western Monarch Count. We also do a lot of habitat restoration work for the Western monarch butterfly, and we engage in some research to better understand the species, how it uses habitats, things like that.
Okay, let's move on to another really interesting pollinator and just really cool insects, bumblebees. Bumblebees are amazing. Tell us about the work you guys are doing with them.
Yeah, so we work on bumblebee conservation across North America. And like with our butterfly work, we engage in applied research, community science. We develop habitat restoration guidance, conservation planning, things like that. We've done a lot of work over the years to better understand where bumblebees occur, which species are most imperiled and which ones are doing all right, and what they need, how can we better protect and restore their habitats. And so one of our flagship efforts currently around bumblebees is we run bumblebee atlases currently in 20 states, including California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, several of the mountain states, and states in the Midwest and southeastern U.S.
What is a bumblebee atlas, and how do people get involved with that?
Yeah, with these bumblebee atlases, we invite volunteers to essentially adopt a grid cell, and we've overlaid a grid onto entire states. And so someone can adopt a grid cell in their backyard or one of their favorite places to go hiking. And we have a standardized protocol and ask the volunteers to use that protocol and essentially census the bumblebees within that grid cell and report their findings. And so it's a protocol that they don't have to kill the bumblebees. They just capture them, cool them down, take photos of them, and release them. And then they share their photos with the Xerces Society. And And through this project, we've been able to learn a lot. And through the thousands of volunteers who have engaged in it, we've been able to learn a lot about where species that we think are imperiled or endangered occur, and specifically what they need, what kinds of flowers they use. We've learned a little bit about where they're nesting and some other features of landscapes that may be relevant that directly inform guidance around habitat management for the benefit of bumblebees and specifically some of our imperiled species of bumblebees.
Well, earlier you mentioned freshwater mussels, native species mussels, and if you want, you could talk a little bit about invasive species because they've been a lot in the news too. But I'd like to know what's going on up on the Klamath River with all the restoration work going on up there with freshwater mussels.
Sure. Yeah. So we have been working to better understand and conserve the freshwater mussel fauna of the western U.S. through the Xerces Society. And our mussel conservation work has focused a lot on identifying where these underappreciated animals live, which species are most endangered, and then protecting the endangered species. So we've done a lot of work on the western ridge mussel. And this is a species, the western ridge mussel, that has declined extensively from a lot of its historic range, including much of its range in California. It's now absent from a large portion of the state, as well as many of its historic sites in other states like Oregon and Washington and parts of Idaho. And the Western Ridge Mussel, one of the few places where it still occurs is in the Klamath River. There are a few rivers where you can still find this species in abundance. And the Klamath River is one of them. And so we have worked with several partners, including the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to protect Western Ridge Mussels as the dams were coming out on the Klamath River. So we worked with, in addition to the Fish and Wildlife Service, we worked with the Klamath Tribes, Karuk Tribe, Yurok Tribe, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Trout Unlimited, and River Design Group, and we helped relocate more than 4,000 Western Ridge Mussels from sites that would be affected by dam removal on this river. We tagged many of these mussels, and some of them were left in place and are part of a study to better understand how mussel relocations, how successful they are, and better understand what this species may need. But this is a species that's being considered for protection under the Endangered Species Act, and the Xerces Society is working to protect all of the remaining populations of this species.
Okay, another interesting endangered species you work with, which I've never personally ever got to see because I'm a Californian, are fireflies, which I've always found fascinating. Tell us a bit about fireflies, because for those of us who live on the West Coast, we don't get to experience them unless we go visit the East Coast. But tell us about fireflies and, you know, how interesting an insect they are.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And I will say that it's a little bit of a misconception that flashing fireflies are only in the eastern U.S. Certainly, as a native Oregonian, I first encountered fireflies in the central U.S. and northeastern U.S. and later in the upper Midwest. But we do have species of fireflies that only glow as larvae in California and Oregon. And we do have some isolated reports of flashing fireflies from many Western states. Many of these flashing firefly species are associated with spring habitats in more arid environments, like Nevada and Arizona, and even, you know, Montana and Utah and Colorado have small populations of flashing fireflies. So we were hearing many anecdotal reports that fireflies were disappearing. And many of these reports were from people who had lived in the same place for a long time. Some of them were from firefly researchers, and that they just weren't as common as they used to be. And so, you know, we thought, gosh, this sounds a lot like what people were saying about bumblebees, you know, a decade prior, before there had been more rigorous research to really document the declines in bumblebees that has since led to a lot of species protection and I think some really proactive conservation. So we set out initially with the goal of trying to better understand what the evidence basis was for anecdotal reports of firefly decline. We have a team, we have a couple full-time conservation biologists who work on fireflies, one based in the Western U.S. and one in the Eastern U.S. And we, our team has completed working with many collaborators, conservation status and extinction risk assessments for most of the fireflies of the U.S. to understand which species are imperiled. Turns out most of the species, we don't know enough to even know if they're imperiled or not. About half of our species are data deficient of fireflies. We've developed conservation management guidance. We've launched a firefly atlas. So I mentioned the bumblebee atlas earlier. The firefly atlas engages volunteers and land managers and others in conducting surveys for and reporting observations of fireflies. And anyone, including people in California, can report information to the Firefly Atlas. By the way, California has a really neat species, the California pink glowworm.
Where would one find those?
Oh, where would one find the California pink glowworm? It's stunning. I can send you a map if you look on iNaturalist for California pink glowworm. And we also probably have some records on the Firefly Atlas as well for this particular species, but it's not a target of the Firefly Atlas. So I think iNaturalist would be the most comprehensive source, but it's throughout the state.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we let you go, for folks listening who really find this interesting and important, and I hope everyone does, because without these invertebrates, we won't be able to survive far into the future. What are some cool things that people can do just in their everyday lives that can help and or maybe be involved with your efforts?
So certainly if you have access to land, you know, if you are a homeowner or a renter or have access to a plot of land, you can create habitat or protect habitat for pollinators, for example, by planting native wildflowers. We have a lot of guidance on our website regarding, you know, what species to plant depending on where you are. Certainly avoiding pesticides. There are things you can do in your food choices if you're able to and when it's affordable to reduce the pesticide impact on the environment. You can participate in a community science project. So almost anywhere you are, if this is of interest, you can participate in a bumblebee atlas project or a butterfly monitoring project. And often, especially with the bumblebee atlases, the data that are collected are directly used to inform conservation and help, you know, develop strategies for conserving species.
Well, Serena Jepson, Director of the Endangered Species Program for the Xerces Society, thanks for sharing your passion for these amazing creatures that we all depend on, that all creatures great and small depend on, as the saying goes. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll look at the Xerces Society's innovative programs to protect and restore pollinators from cityscapes to countryside. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Our next guest is Mace Vaughn. Mace is the Xerces Society Pollinator and Agricultural Biodiversity Director, and he joins us now from his home in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
All right. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I'd like to find out about the actual program that you run. When did that start? And just tell us about its origins and how it's evolved, because it's become, you know, a pretty big deal.
Yeah, so it actually has its roots in California, collaborating with scientists at the University of California, Davis, University of California, Berkeley. We were working with a scientist at the time whose name is Claire Kremen. She's now actually at the University of British Columbia. And at that time, she was doing research on trying to understand the value of habitat, or how habitat and plantings of wildflowers and flowering shrubs on farms in California's Central Valley affected native bee abundance and diversity around these different farms. So she was doing this really exciting research on the importance and the value of hedgerows and different flower plantings, and approached Xerces to ask, hey, could we help in taking her research and bringing it to partners, farmers, and other partners in the Central Valley? So we started working with her, developing demonstration plantings and teaching and doing outreach and helping farmers create habitat. And that was back in 2002. That led to a collaboration with USDA and the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which ultimately led to a 20-year partnership where I was able to build a team of experts in California, but Oregon, Washington, all the way to Maine, who are working with farmers and ranchers and now foresters to help them understand how to create new habitat, how to manage habitat, how to implement pesticide risk reduction, do all these different things on working landscapes, so farms and ranches and forests, for the benefit of pollinators. So it all had its roots in California, just south of Chico.
Well, let's talk about the pollinators themselves. You know, because most people, when they hear pollination, they just think of bees, you know, honeybees, like you mentioned earlier, which are European. They're not even native to the United States. But there's just a vast array of pollinators. Could you just kind of give us a sense of, you know, the multitude of species that perform this essential task and how important it is? What, it's 85% of, you know, the plants that we depend on that have flowers and fruits depend on them.
That's right. Yeah, 85% of flowering plants need a pollinator, usually an insect, yeah, to move that pollen from flower to flower, to set seed and to set fruit. The diversity of pollinators to me has been, frankly, and I mentioned this earlier, what really got me hooked. So you've got native bees, so you've got hundreds more, you know, if you look at all of North America, let's say roughly 4,000 species, a little less of native bees that, you know, are out there on our flowers. These are bumblebees. These are green metallic sweat bees. These are ground nesting tickle bees that we call these digger bees that you can find thousands of them in little holes spread across some yards and school fields, and kids come out and play with them. You've got mason bees. There's just a huge variety. Sunflower bees, just this tremendous variety of native bee species. And on top of that, you've got butterflies. You've got 700 butterfly species, give or take, in the U.S. They have their own diversity. Super common that, you know, people recognize them. But there are moths that pollinate. There are flies. Some are called flower flies, even, and they hover in the air, you know, around flowers, and you find them all over the place. And they do other great things, like their larvae eat aphids. So you've got your flies, you've got wasps that get have a bad reputation, but do a ton of good work in terms of pollination, as well as pest control in your garden. Beetles, there's just a huge variety of different insects, you know, thousands of different species that are out there on your flowers, pollinating these plants and doing other work as well. Like I said, keeping your pest insects kind of in check.
They're like the unsung heroes of nature.
You know, I think that's true. Like, people tend to focus on honeybees as pollinators. And don't get me wrong, they're super important pollinators, particularly in agriculture. But there are these thousands of other species that are out there that, until you start to look for them and notice them, you might not even see them. And they're all around you. And that, to me, is what makes it fun. Like, if you're looking for these, if you know, if you can train your eye to see these small animals, it opens up a whole new world that's been right with you all along. And for me, that's both inspiring and, I don't know, makes going for a walk in the neighborhood a lot more fun.
Well, I'd like to talk about those landscapes like our neighborhoods. And I'd kind of like to, let's start with the bigger landscapes, and let's work our way down, all the way down to my backyard, okay?
Sure. Sounds great.
So let's start with talking about, you know, natural landscapes and what kinds of things we can do to, you know, make sure that they are healthy for pollinators.
So we look at big natural landscapes, you know, think of the national parks, think of Forest Service, like our public forests and our public lands. It's important there that we understand and that we ideally manage those habitats with pollinators and all of sort of wildlife in mind. And so that means avoiding things like overgrazing. That means, you know, a lot of the fuel reduction efforts or some of the controlled fire efforts that are out there that are meant to help maintain our public lands. A lot of those end up releasing wildflowers, you know, leading to more wildflower abundance, leading to more shrub, flowering shrub abundance. So all of those practices that we're doing more and more of these days to try to, you know, protect California, for example, and other parts of the West, you know, from catastrophic wildfires can go a long way towards supporting pollinator habitat as well, because we're managing those lands for flowering plants. And ideally, land managers have that as a goal.
And then what about like big landscapes where, like, you know, people have cattle, rangeland, places like that?
Yeah, this is where my team works. Rangelands, farmland, these are places where if we think about and incorporate pollinators into our management goals, there's a lot that we can do. So if we look at, you know, typically in rangeland, there's been a real focus on grass, managing for grass. But we are doing, actually, Xerces is in the middle right now of doing a study with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to document the nutritional value of, 50 or 60 different wildflower species for livestock, helping to make the case that we can manage our rangelands. If we manage our rangelands for wildflowers that were benefiting pollinators and also benefiting the nutritional needs of livestock. And if we're going to manage for those wildflowers, some of the changes we need to think about are changes we're already making when it comes to more sustainable grazing management on rangeland. So maybe more higher intensity for short periods of time and then long rests, and letting a pasture rest, a piece of rangeland rest, so that you could have those wildflowers and grasses and other things grow, flower, bloom, set seed, and drop that seed in order to have then seed in the ground to come back in the future. That rest also lets those roots grow deeper, lets those plants become healthier, which makes them more drought resistant and actually even helps with water infiltration. So during times of drought, when you get a little bit of rain, having, you know, pasture that's well managed like that leads to more drought resistance as well. So it's a real win-win for pollinators as well as the longer term sustainability of rangelands.
And I'm curious, you know, when you work with ranchers and farmers, what the learning curve is like for them to go from, you know, they're maybe not interested in this and to, you know, to where they incorporate it into their business plan, the way they live their lives, and how, you know, that kind of changes over time and how they view it.
Yeah, to be quite honest about it, the ranchers that we work with most closely tend to be those who've been on the land for usually a couple of generations and have got a bit more security in that under that model, you may make a little bit less money, you know, than sort of pushing your ground hard. The benefit, however, is that you're actually working oftentimes a lot less. It's often fewer hours to do the work, but you're maybe not maximizing the number of pounds of meat that might come off the ground, you know, the pounds of cattle you might raise. But like I said, it can be done, it's less work, and it leads to more resilience during those times of drought. Like when it's droughty, your plants are healthy and they're better able to manage to withstand that, and then they're that much more productive. So you're better off during those harsh periods. But it takes time to sort of build the relationships. My staff work pretty closely with ranchers in California, but also in the Great Plains. That's where the bulk of this work is going on right now, in the Dakotas and in Nebraska and Kansas. And there it's a lot of relationship building and going and working with folks. A lot of bison ranches are interested in this right now. Just spending time on the land and working with folks. And it's important to me to build those relationships and for my staff to work closely with those producers over time.
And how about farms and orchards? What kind of work do you do with farmers and agricultural people that grow, you know, orchard crops to kind of help them figure out that this is really good for them in the long run?
Yeah, we do a couple of things. We work with large orchards. You know, some of their orchards we work with are, you know, hundreds, thousands of acres. The role of my team is to help make the work of understanding what you could do on the ground, kind of bring, like helping to bring a plan together And to help figure out how do you find the plants, how do you get it on the ground. And we're trying to get practices like hedgerows, which are a really useful sort of gateway into habitat, whether you're an orchardist or, you know, you're growing tomatoes or sunflowers or raspberries or grapes, or hedgerows are really useful and I think really effective way to for somebody to get into bringing habitat onto a farm that maybe doesn't have any. They're relatively easy to set up and plant. They're relatively easy to manage because you can roll out a drip line to irrigate them. So just a simple line to put drip irrigation on the plants. You can use very little water, but have a high likelihood of success. And part of what we are trying to do through that work is illustrate how you plant that habitat, you're not going to probably supply all of your pollination needs. I mean, I need to be honest about that. But you do increase your native pollinators, and you do increase some pollination around those plantings. You also increase those other beneficial insects that have the potential to move into your orchards or your grapes or whatever it might be that could then attack, you know, your crop pests. You're also increasing water infiltration on your farm. You're preventing drifting dust and pesticides coming into your farm or leaving your farm. You are, well, sequestering carbon. And there are today still carbon markets that you can tap into. In fact, we've got a project trying to document how much carbon you could be storing in something like a hedgerow so that you could then take that. If you planted 2 miles of hedgerows, you could have a significant, you know, amount of carbon that you're storing that could be worth something. So we're trying to tie together all of these benefits of bringing some diversity to a farm in order to have these multiple benefits. So yeah, we understand, you know, farm production is, it's a challenge and, you know, you make a big farm and it's things are more efficient, but like you have the potential to create a landscape that the only thing alive on it are the your trees or your crop that you've planted. And there's such a role to be played, a huge role that can be played and by many farmers is being played to create habitat, to really try to bring back biodiversity, especially into a place like the Central Valley of California that's so intensively managed in agriculture. You know, it's a landscape that from the edges moving in, we need to try to bring more of that habitat in order to sustain pollinators, monarch butterflies, you know, you name it.
Well, let's talk about more urban type landscapes and starting with like highways and freeways and roadways and then and cities. You know, what kind of work can be done to kind of help those places be friendlier for pollinators?
I mean, much of the same. So, you know, on roadsides, big highways, all across the country, there are efforts to, frankly, save a little bit of money for the departments of transportation by mowing less frequently. So that allows the wildflowers that are there to bloom, to grow and to bloom and flower and, you know, set seed and drop seed. And, you know, we still need to think about safety. And so there is, it's still important to mow close to the edges and keep a certain area tight. But there's a lot of opportunity farther away from the road itself to really be managing for, say, pollinators. And so that's one idea. A lot of cities are creating sort of natural, small natural areas, natural plantings in their parks. I lived in Portland, Oregon for 22 years prior to moving to Calgary, Alberta about 2 years ago. And it was really interesting to watch the park system in Portland take on this idea of sort of small natural areas in their very urban parks. So there would be a nice planting full of native wildflowers, native shrubs that would have a pathway through it. So you could bring more of this biodiversity and nature in a into a formal park.
Well, let's talk about our yards.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So what can I do as a homeowner in my own yard to help pollinators?
I mean, you could just work on beautifying your yard by taking some of your lawn out and planting it with wildflowers, ideally native wildflowers. So you can go to the Xerces Society website. We've got great, you know, wildflower native plant lists for monarch butterflies and for pollinators and all sorts of things. So you can create a beautiful wildflower planting, any size, whatever size fit works for you. You put 2 plants in the ground, that's great. You can plant some native shrubs that are also good for pollinators and other beneficial insects and put those maybe around the edge of your property. Maybe you put a little, your own little mini hedgerow along the sidewalk out front. So you've got some nice flowering plants there. And if you've got room for trees, you know, you can bring a tree in. If you think about it, a tree like, take a basswood tree, for example, and a linden tree, common city tree in a lot of cities all across the country. And when that is mature, maybe it's 30 feet tall, 40 feet tall, 80 feet tall, when they're really mature, it's like having a wildflower meadow in the air. And you could, you know, you could go so crazy as to plant a pollinator meadow, take your lawn out. And no matter what, if you're in an urban landscape, you know, you mow or put a nice edge on it so it looks tidy, like, oh, hey, wait, this is on purpose. You maybe get a sign from the Xerces Society that says, hey, this is pollinator habitat. And all of a sudden, you have a landscape that is natural and native, but it's got a nice edge. Everyone loves an edge. So it looks tidy and put together. And I don't know, it opens people's eyes to the possibilities. Put a little sign on it and they're like, oh, pollinator habitat. That's cool.
Well, Mace Vaughn, thanks for sharing your expertise and your passion for helping our pollinators and your work with the Xerces Society. Thanks so much for joining us. It was really interesting.
Dave, it was a real pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks again to our guests from the Xerces Society, Executive Director Scott Black, Endangered Species Director Serena Jepson, and Pollinator and Agricultural Biodiversity Director Mace Vaughn. You can learn more about the work of the Xerces Society and how you can help, from making a donation to creating pollinator-friendly habitat in your yard, at xerces.org. That's xerces.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.